I begin, I want to mention that of all the children of the source of Anto that I've come across, done by authors, this, I mean, about him, about his work, was the largest single work is this. It's very famous about that cut, which I mentioned. I don't know if I mentioned this. I mistake, I brought the second cut to the first. This is two-volume cut, the recital. I regard this, my humble opinion, is the best work on Rabbi Yisrael, because it works essentially with his own Kesuvim. Excerpts are very well organized. Rabbi Yisrael Mesalant, this is a grandson of his, the Rav Chaim Yitzchak Lipkin. There are two volumes. This is an excellent work. I don't know, but hundreds of years ago, it's put out in 54 by Netzach. You have to ask him, if you know it was put out by Netzach, so you know how to identify. Can you ask someone? He also, this Lipkin, is the author of a five-volume work, Encyclopedia of Mitzvahs, which is excellent. It's good. It's good. It's more hagiography than, you see, it's warm, it's inspired, it's not a study on the Shittas HaMesach, but it does convey hundreds of uvdes and words which you can get an aura and push it for one's own. It's chaskus, that's for Radai, it's excellent. Everything he did, by the way, is very inspired and it's well. He's up there less than Shama, he's up already. He lives in Yerushalayim. I don't know if he has a kind of a serious following here in Eretz Yisrael, but he deserves it. But everything he wrote is very, very well done. But this is not really an analysis of Eretz Yisrael and his teachings. And that's what we want to try to do. But you first have to take a look at a little bit of his history, and for that I'm helping myself for an outline of his history, life, with the Musabarabed cats. Those of you who have gone through this will find most of this, I imagine, familiar. The best we can do is to review it and to try to do it as succinctly as we can. So Salanta was born in Tovkuf Ayin, equivalent to 1810. Not so long after the Ptira of the Gur. He was born in a town called Zager, which, if you take a look at the geographic map, what I'm about to say now, it's a conjecture. I didn't see this in any authoritative source, except in one essay by his name now, he was a later German Jewish Orthodox writer, historian. I mean, I'm not quoting him in this context because I generally side with his point of view, but in this one matter, he has an enlightening insight. The town of Zagier was on the boundary between Lithuania and Latvia. The character and culture of the local populations is a blend between the East European, Russian, Polish outlook and makeup, psychological makeup, and the German. Lithuanian Jewry was, in general, calm manner, mentally keen, intellectually inclined, by which I don't mean secular intellectualism. I mean, in Yahadus, they were Torah Jews of the mind, not given to easy enthusiasm, not given to easy emotionalism, solid. A lot of Yashuas in the earlier generations among them, too late, they clashed with the Haskalah, it was a different story. But side by side with this prime characteristic of love of learning, it was also characterized by a lot of chesed, a lot of tmimus in their, you know, interhuman relations. This is the background, the Lithuanian Jewish background, very is in a few simple words. But in that area of Lithuania, which was right near Latvia, there was another influence. There was a German influence too. The German influence began to inject, led to the infiltration of echoes of what was happening in the West. But in the West, it was the age of the explosion of reform came just 10 years later. Out of Schmad, a monumental struggle between the old Jewish world and the new emancipation. Echoes of that started infiltrating. The Jews who came from that area were in inner feeling and thinking something of a blend. They were essentially East European Jews. But there was an openness, a greater openness to Western cultural interests. They were more aware, some of them because of business reasons. They traveled a lot into East Prussia for commerce, and they were made sensitive to what was happening over there, and also to a certain type of German energy, ambition. I mean, it's hard for me to formulate it more precisely. That also blended into the character of the Jews living in that area. It was there that Bogusilov was born. Much of his later breadth of interest and his sensitivity to the conflicting currents of East and West, to which most of his contemporaries were not that keen. They were not aware of it. But it was affecting them. And he, with his genius, his brilliance, his godless, he had like a seismograph into him. His antenna picked up a lot of things that most other people didn't even see. But was going to happen, it was going to explode 30 years later, 40 years later. He saw it earlier. This helps to provide an insight into some of the things that at least that triggered his interests and his efforts. At the age of 12, his father felt that he should go away to learn elsewhere, should be Mekayim of the Galilim Kantor. And his father was a ranking Talmid Chacham, was one of the great Talmid Chachamim of the age. But for his vocation, he was a simple Melamed. Melamed was children. He taught his own child. Of course, it's a mark of the extent to which Torah had become widespread in the Lithuania of 30 years, only 10 years after the Goyen's Ptira, but just decades after the Goyen's activities. Very close to the founding of Alojan. It's a mark of the Torah richness of those communities that very big Talmidei Chachamim wandered around, weren't recognized, were not Rabbonim, were not Rosh Yeshivas. And there were thousands of Jews like that. I think I once told you that the Pilei Eger, about 1830, traveled through Vilna, the Goyen city, on the way to a chasan of one of his children in Poland. He had a son in Warsaw, Shlomo Eger. On the way to a chasan of one of his children, traveled through Vilna, so wherever Pilei Eger went. So of course there were tremendous Kabbalah's problems, tremendous outpouring of Kabbalah. And the Mekah Hillel decided that even though since the Ptir of the Goen, which was really only 1798, just 30 years or so earlier, but since the Ptir of the Goen, there wasn't going to be any more Rov in Vilna. It would be a Vardar Rabbonin, but not a Dayan, a Moira Hero, and maybe a Rosh Bezdin, a Magid, but not the Magidim there. I told you, I think, also once were also the Gedolim B'Torah. But there wasn't going to be a Rov, except the Kinaigim. So they thought, he's worthy of it. So they tried to, you know, to inveigle him, and he was considering it. Now, he was being taken to some event for some Kabbalah's Ponim, and all of the Agronim, all of the, called them Balagolas, the coach drivers, the wagon drivers, all vied for the honor of taking him. And finally, well, a few of them won together. Neither would let go. So it looks like, I'm not clear on this, two or three were up on the driver's seat, taking turns whipping the horses, and here's Kiveya sitting inside, and his ear suddenly catches that these, wagon drivers, they know Shas. So he heard Shas being, you know, hurled about. So when he got to his destination, so he told the Roshim of the Vilna Kehila, I can't be a Rov in a city in which the wagoneers know Shas, in which there are wagoneers. Now, be forgiven, he was also an Agronim. He could have been. But he tells a story about the Philegas Godless and his Akoponim. It's the world in which the father of Rav Sol Salanter functioned. Never acknowledged. At the age of 12, he sends him to one of the leading Goyim of the age, Tzvi Broider of Salant. He was a colleague, but there was a lot of sending of Chiddush HaTorah between Eger and him, forwards and backwards, so you can sense from that who he was. Rabbi Eger used to call him in Yiddish, the Groyse Rebbe Reb Tzvi, you know, the big Rebbe Reb Tzvi. Okay, now this is where, Rabbi Kivayger was then the Rav of Salam, this is where this 12-year-old was brought. No, there was a lot of, but he took him into his kibbutz. So he had seven talmidim, and then every one of them became a goyim b'yisur. They were already before something. He was a kid, Rebbe Yisrael was then 12 years old. So the Rebbetzin was upset, others were upset. Why are you paying so much attention? So the Rebbetzin once said, within the hearing of this young bochur, she said to her husband, what are you putting in all your kachas to the son of this woman, or the son of that malamed? She didn't know who Rabbi Saul's father was, or he was. So he got upset for the covet of his father. So he said to her, my tata, the malamed, can may I learn in the asach rabon? My father, the malamed, is more of a lamed than many rabon. So she threw him out of the house. So the mother of Tzvi started pacifying her. She should let him into the house. She said, no, get away from that. So she would watch, he shouldn't get it, he would take him in through a window. She would appear, it would fly here. Until one time, I have to tell you about this, that Shib Reuter, that he learned the Amida. Most of the hours of the day, the night that he learned standing for 30 years. So he became crippled on his legs. Or he couldn't continue that way. That was the serious efforts for the Torah. A time came when the Rebbetzin, had to make Sholem at the Yelam. He learned there a number of years, and he mastered Shas through Alphys. He learned the whole Rif. 7 years, he was still a young boy, I don't know exactly the age, he was a teenager. And a goyim came in one day to spend his talk and learning of Shalom, he got all the Tzibroida. And Tzibroida involved this Yelid, and that goyim was upset, putting me up against the Yelid like this. So after they talked to Lenin, and he acquired the name then the kleiner Haufes, the small rich, the Haufasi HaKotel. That was a nickname that the Gesorah was given in his teens. Not widely known, this. These are tidbits that tell something. And then the Rebbe said, well, sorry. She said, that this yellow dress, it was a little riff and a little office. So her own husband then said to her, said, you see what others say about him? So you can see that it's from him, that when he took her up for the covenant of his father, that you shouldn't get angry with him. You might shalom with him, and he didn't have to go through the window. Now, at the age of 14, he composed a choveres with Chiddush HaTorah, and he sent it to Rav Gireini. And, you know, he indicated that he was a child, he was young, but he was hoping that the Chiddush HaTorah would find favor in Gireini's eyes. But Gireini didn't answer. Now, there are two versions of this. One is that he wrote that he was very young. The other that he didn't write about his age. But the Chilean didn't answer, that's according to all the versions. Then, once a leading Lamban from Salant visited Posen and went to see Chilea, so Chilea took advantage of his visit to tell him that he had deceived some kind of a choveres with extraordinary, goyne's and Chiddush HaTorah, from some Lamban here you have to apply the two versions, in Salant, and he didn't answer him. Why? Because he was afraid. He thought to himself, there is such a great Goren as Ratzimoy, they're all in Salant. So why doesn't this Lamban deal with him? He probably wants to make it hard for him. He's probably trying to compete with him. And he must be unfriendly to him. So he thought, that's what he wrote to me. So I should become a partner to this. Careful they were. He said, that's why he didn't answer. Then he found out, after all, this was only a yellet. And I think that Tzivreide knew that he was writing to Vega, so then it seems he did answer. For 18 years, he learned in Salam. He was married already by this time, but I want to get to to the Nakuda of his life. During those years, there were very few of the Shainim and Achainim available in most Bote Medroshim, certainly not in private homes of London. And most London learned either Machshor or Pnei Yeshua style. They had very few of the Shainim and have, except those that were printed in the rear of the Shasim. But the learning, the Ikir, even the greatest Talmid HaChachamim, was Amasa, on the spot. The Ikir was Rashi Tosfos, Machshor, and some had Pnei Yeshua. And for 18 years' time, Rabbi Yisrael learned like that. One of the characteristics of that style of learning was that the later method of Reb Chaim, conceptualization, was not yet then widely known. There was a few men, Yabavke and Galicia, there was the Pesach Hashem. A little bit later, about 1830s, the Menachas Chinuch, who were Dafke there in a country that was very foreign to the later, very alien to the later Reb Chaim Derech. But it was Dafke, those two, among the Achainim, who laid down the foundations for the later development of conceptualization and learning. Anybody who takes a look at either the Ktzos or the Chinuch sees that that's their whole method. It's analytic, it's conceptual, it's atomic. Goes down to the root of everything. The earlier Derech HaLimud was not conceptual, it was textual, and it dealt largely with, not even with comparing texts from other Gemaras, except, comparing texts, yes, but Marshal Pnei Yeshua style, which meant a lot of pilpul, very sharp, not necessarily in immediate local atomic analysis, but they learned a lot, and they kept learning Kol Yemei Chayayim, so they would pick up, a lumpen of this kind wouldn't work through defining, through the attempt to define and conceptualize the local themes and issues through the Rishonim. He worked through comparisons of texts from all over Shas. So it required tremendous memories and tremendous keenness of association. In that keenness of association, which is called pilpul, pepper, there was a lot of brilliance, but there wasn't necessarily throughout consistent truth. It was sharp. It was fire. It's not the way the Goan learned. But the rest of Lithuania, for all of the fact that there was, that he caused a lot of asmoda to develop, until Valozhin came into its later decades, the Shittas HaPilpul was not supplanted in most of Lithuania by the new Derech. It was only Reb Chaim who really instituted it, and before him, the Netziv was a master of everything, tremendous Boki, but also not a conceptualizer. He was a Pashti. He wanted to know Pshat in the text. But he knew Palaterikula, and his, by the way, I have to tell you that the Netziv's great contribution was his comparison of Shas with the Madrash HaAlocha, with Safro, Safri, Achilta, right? In order to learn Pshat in Shas, he brought to bear that he knew all of the sources of Shas, not just comparative texts. But he was a Pashtun Goini, but his union was Pshat. The Chaim made conceptualization prevalent in the world of the Lithuanian yeshivas. But at the time that we're talking, the first decades of the century, well I shouldn't say it was, if you're talking about the Tavkuf, the Jewish dates, it was the last decades of that century. What ruled was Pilpul. Why do I emphasize this? What? I said, again, who?
First one, just before Abraham?
Before Abraham, the Netziv. So the Netziv of Valozhin did not conceptualize. Before, but the Yisrael grew up in a pilpul world, very fiery, very sharp, knew everything, as the classic saying goes, he could put an elephant through an eye of a needle. He was resourceful and full of initiative. He became dissatisfied. He felt something was wrong. This was the beginning of the revolution in his own life, which later caused him to try to mount a revolution elsewhere.
Where did
they live? They lived in Galicia. They lived far away from the Lithuanian sea. Galicia was Austria-Hungary for the First World War. It was a dismembered part of Poland, which in 1796 was divided three ways. There were two partitions. So one part went into Russia, one part it was absorbed by Germany, and one of Kiberia's part of Poland became German, and Galicia became Austria-Hungary. But it was southern Poland.
That was more like Western Europe or Eastern Europe?
No, it was Eastern Europe. It's there that Hasidus enjoyed its greatest victories, though the Tzos and the Mechas Chinuch were not Hasidus. But the style of learning in Galicia, everywhere around them, was not conceptual. They were. Now, they were not as keenly conceptual as Reb Chaim. But the whole background, the whole plowing of, you know, until a Shitta acquires, I would say, not just prominence, until it's accepted, and then until it's required, prominence becomes prevalent, it's like in any sphere of knowledge or technology, there's a lot of preparation, a lot of plowing the ground that has to take place. They were such harshik. They plowed the ground of learning, and as a matter of fact, it tells, the Ktzas HaChoshen was the most popular sefer. They used to say that if somebody would, the Bochum would go out for walks and couldn't tear themselves away from a Ktzas. Somebody said that if somebody were an outsider would go take a walk in the fields around Tells, you could smell the fragrance of the Ktzos. Wherever you went, you heard Ktzos. So it became, but that was transcultural, you know, different countries. But, you know, the Torah is international.
And that was the beginning of the Ktzos in the Bosnian, the 1800s?
Beginning of the 1800s, 1820, 1830s. That's when they were functioning. Now, but Rabbi Israel is a product, and for 18 years he was a product of the pupil shit. Came dissatisfied.
How did Reb Chaim Palashev?
Shat. The Netziv must have learned from what I gather, from what one hears, like Reb Chaim. Reb Chaim was a pshatler. Knew kola tera kola, but everywhere. He wanted to know the shteida, what's written. And that he was mekabel from the Gro. That emphasis, we have to mention that the Gro saw that insistence on pshat and the hope that it would become widely prevalent as the major key for healing any of the psychological, spiritual, of the spiritual illnesses of the age. That was his answer to Haskola, to learn the Torah truthfully. Truth, not brilliance. Not, it goes without saying that he had more brilliance than anybody else, but he wasn't looking to scintillate, to shine. He wasn't looking to you know, there was no artificial glow over there. Of course, in the history of our people, of Klal Yisrael, in the history of Torah among us, when you later compare, you can only do it retroactively, what was happening in the world around us, the type of challenge that was already present and that was coming, you see that the Hashgacha brought it about that the great teachers of Torah should everywhere somehow, whether they did it consciously or not, anticipate some type. They forged responses in anticipation to a certain type of challenge that came from around them. But I don't want to belabor this further. He became dissatisfied with himself. And at that juncture in his life, he started taking note of one of the Lamdim in Salant who had been a Talmud in Reb Chaim, Reb Zundel Salant. And he began to suspect that this Reb Zundel was hiding himself. He watched and he watched. And just somehow, he seemed like it was a tzaddik mister. It was a guy in Oilam. And nobody ever knew about it. We didn't dress with any kind of rabbinic style. We wore a peltzel, they say, you know, a little leather coat. Like small townspeople. None of the trappings of office around him. And one day, and the soul was magnetically drawn after him, followed him on a walk at some distance, thinking that Absalom wasn't noticing him, but he wanted to see, where's he going to now, what's he going to do? Just curiosity, well, Ruchni is the curiosity, became a magnet. He's following him. All of a sudden, on this walk, Absalom turns around, and looked him in the eyes, and he said to him, Zundel, you want to be a Yerei Shemayim? Yisrael, you want to be a Yerei Shemayim? Will send a Yerei Shemayim? Lechem Musar. That's all he said to him. Yisrael later related that it was like a fire went through. His whole life changed course. A few words, he decided then and there he has to become a different type of Jew. But then he started applying himself to break with pupil radically. Everything has extremes, and everything has moderated forms. At that point, he felt so strongly that he had gone on a wrong path that he just wouldn't hear of anything other than pshat. I have to stop at this moment, and I have to tell you something about what happened in relation to his shivus. A few years earlier than this, I want to bring this in, so that you should hear how much Musa's sensitivity there was even before it became a shidduch in those areas. A shidduch was talked for him with a certain girl. Forget, you know, now names and father. Al Kochem, a Jew was a rich Jew. He was going to give 300 ruble liter. Now, so that this young man should be able to sit and learn. 300 ruble was a sizable sum of money. And then it turned out that he became poor. He became a Yored, lost his possessions, lost his money, and a certain other Yavir in another city became aware of this. And did the following. he took himself to this mechutn, knowing that he was brokenhearted and he couldn't possibly meet his commitment. He went to him, another Jew, and he said to him, look, I will give you, I think it was 10,000 Jews, that you should be Meichel. You should be Meichel the Shiva. And I'll take care of him, I don't know if he said, the rest of his life. I'll do everything, you know, that needs to be done for such a genius. He's a genius already, young boy. And maybe it's better for him if the cloud is soil, that you should be Meichel. Broken-hearted, this Jew takes himself to young Yisrael's father. And he tells his father the whole Maisa. And he says, look, I have to tell you the truth. I'm not able to meet my godly commitment. As we're showing that Yisrael should be left because of me, should have to go become a red man after some trade or whatever was possible, and I should go away from her. And I have such and such an offer. No, maybe it was, no, the opposite. That other Jew was going to give, I told it to you mistaken, my memory was faulty. He was going to give the initial mechutn a handsome sum of money, whatever he wanted, to be Mephias him. He should forego it. And he was willing to give Yisrael as a nadin 10,000 rubles instead of 300 rubles. He went to him, and that mechutn himself went afterwards to Yisrael, to the chosn's father, and to the chosn to tell them, I can't do what I was committed to do, but look, my Hashgacha is watching over you, and such an offer is being made to you by so and so, so I'm willing to be my friend. You know what Yisrael's father did? He ran over to the closet, pulled out whiskey, and said, called in his wife and some cookies. The shidduch hadn't yet been finalized. He pulled some cookies and he called his wife in, and he grabbed hold of the mechutn, and he told him, Mazel tov, mechutn, Mazel tov. And the boy also, I mean, they weren't going to, yes money, no money. That's how people set themselves on the task of learning a whole life without kolo stipend to speak up. By the way, it was in his later years made it possible that the first kolo should begin. Although it wasn't in his own lifetime, but there was a certain an elderly bocher, what was his name, in Germany. He was in Germany, who was a great Talmid Torah, and he started the first Kollel together with Rabbi Tzvi Petterburg, but with one of the Talmidim of Yisrael. But this whole thing of raising up Talmid Torah and looking to get away from Teg, from eating days, and establishing Limud Torah for Avreichim, the COVID, it was all pressed for that. I'll go upon him, but that's a later thing. That's a little bit of I want to call it, it's not an anecdote, it's a tidbit that shows us, that gives us a little bit of a flash into the inner life of these people. Al Kaponim, we'll come back now. After he got to know Reb Zundel, Reb Yisrael spent 2.5 years reviewing all of his attitudes and outlooks and all of his hashkafas. In these 2.5 years, he tried to study all the sources of Torah in all of his areas, in Halacha, in Agoda, in Yisrael, in order to reshape and to formulate clearly his path for the future. During this time, he became for the first time critical of his surroundings. I mean this now, I don't want to say sociologically, you didn't think in those terms. But he looked at the Chevra HaYehudis, at the Chevra HaToranis around him, and he saw things that became deeply disturbing. He saw a lot of Ahavas Torah. He saw a lot of Chesed. He saw a lot of Yerushalayim. He saw that there was a certain selectivity of emphasis in the Yerushalayim of the world. Some things, Baruchumis, Mahadrim up to here. Kashrus was then at a level that a Jew who suspected Chalila that he had eaten the slightest bit of a Davar HaAsur would get sick much. But he also saw that the Devoto Bechaveiro Matzah was very uneven. Side by side with a lot of chesed, yes, there was a lot. But side by side with that, there was also kalus rosh, levity about use of the tongue, about lashon hara, about business matters, cutting a corner. A little bit later, there was a further development of this critical attitude which deeply burned in him. He became aware that in one area of life and death, that the gevirim, the wealthy who usually were the top leadership of the kehillahs, did things that, in his estimate, touched on given you know, basic Torah approaches to life, that touched on shvichas damim, that touched on retzicha, that touched on terrible exploitation of the weakness of others, namely, the you heard of the Chotkin, the 25-year these Russian children that were taken captive, and not just taken captive, each kehillah had to supply a certain number. So the Gevirim bought their way out for their children. What did the Rosh HaKol do? All too often, didn't do it everywhere, but all too often they couldn't meet the quota. They would put their eyes on some Yosem, some child of an almono who was defenseless. On one occasion, Rabbi Sor came to a town, and one such almono, whose child had just been grabbed away from her a few days earlier and was still in an army base in the area, they were sent away for 25 years, in the thousands, in the tens of thousands. But again, you're talking about a 9 million a Jewish population then. This almona came to where Rabbi Yisrael was staying. She threw herself at his feet and sobbed out what had happened to her, that her child had been snatched from her, a young boy, and was still in the army base not far from town, and she was going mad with grief. And this was, I think it was a Thursday night, so I told her to be calm. Shabbos, he was invited to a kiddush in the home of the leading, or one of the leading wealthy people in town, and the whole, you know, mi va mi, the who is who of the town was there at the table. Ran after them, made a bracha, they said, L'chaim, and said, Baramina Mazonis. But Israel leaped to his feet, and he started wildly screaming, You're a Shaina Yid, you're a Rotzchim. I don't know the exact words, either he screamed, Osal Histako Bechnei Rosha, or some similar name, and ran out of the room. They say, either he said it or he said it later, like as if a snake had been. And everybody ran after him to pacify him. And he moved, but then it was already a world going. And he said, until you take that child out of their hands and bring him back here, I don't want to see any of you. I don't want to know anything. But it wasn't the solution to the problem. But the Yisrael couldn't live with this was an extreme example, the discrepancy between a great deal of Yerushalayim and Ahavas Torah in some areas, and in some areas, like sad gaps in the Ben Adam L'Chaveiro sphere of Torah. He also noted, there are other things that he noted. He noted that many of the young people were in a state of extreme unrest, of disquiet. Best minds were running away, were looking to get away. He didn't agree with the way of just suppressing inner protest or what the Haskalah worked on, what the Haskalah tried to drum up, and the film world. What was its reaction? Don't read a book, don't do this, don't do that, don't talk to so-and-so. That to him also was was something that was not an answer, because whatever might be the case with reference to each yachid, that each yachid was precious, but he didn't hold that it was an answer, certainly, to the enormous challenge that he saw more and more clearly was rolling in from the West. I've jumped ahead a little bit, because what I've told you now, even though it developed of this thread and this thought, the feeling and this attitude became a thick cord, a thick rope years later, but its beginnings were during these 2.5 years. 2.5 years, an accomplished young Goren sits and does nothing else other than to re-examine all of his presuppositions. After those 2.5 years, he was already set on his path. By then, he had come to the conclusion that the limud of Musar, not just as a continuation of the methods of all the classic Bali Musar, but with a new style and method and technique, had to be made an integral part of the Torah curriculum of adults and youngsters, of men and women. In fact, he held that this was the one area of Torah which was equally binding, that if there was no time for anything else, that this one area of Torah was equally binding on London and simple Jew, on child and adult, on men and women. What was this limud? There were Musa Svarim before. There was the Chavos Avodos, there was the Echos Tzadikim, there was the Rabbeinu Yonah, and there was the Shavua HaKodesh, and the Domayu, and tens of, and more of these, for whom there was endless reverence in the Jewish world, always. What? I'm sorry, did I miss something? Okay. But that limud was not seen as an integral limud that you should have to spend hours a day on it, that you should have to work at it, to turn it into, to internalize it, to make it a major part of your program of becoming a Jew. How was it learned to them? Even those who learned it regularly would learn a little bit before limud, or learning Gemara. 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening. People learn. But the learning was for iyun, for the sake, for the hope of acquiring inspiration by acquiring knowledge. They learned the Chavos Avodos and saw him like that to know what's the truth, what does he teach. And if we'll know what he teaches, so sooner or later we'll take it to heart. It'll memela become internalized. Rabbi Saul did not hold that it would memela become internalized. It was so held that it had to be worked at with a new method and a new technique. Well, how was he going to... See, I skip a lot now of the history of his life, which I'll come back to. How was he going to get other Jews to join him, to accept his views? How was he going to disseminate this approach? How was he going to turn it into a regular program? He went through several experimental stages in this. I have not yet told you what the major ingredient was, not just in form. I said that he held that you have to make it an integral part. But how? I haven't told you that at all yet. But first I want to get to his attempts at making it, at turning it from a personal experience and a personal conviction into a movement. So first, he thought the way was for him to become a Maggid, and he started traveling, and in order to give it respectability, he started saying shiurim here in halacha in order to show off, so that everybody should know that the person behind this is a goyim of world proportions. The Feirish, he departed from his own, he had for so many years suffered, you know, the soul anguish of transforming, of sublimating all of his, you know, it's natural that if a person, you know, is a goyim intellectually, that he wants to shine sometimes. So first he broke that in himself. And then he decided, for the sake of this cause, people had to know that the person behind, the individual behind this new shitta, was himself a goyim whom nobody could dismiss on the grounds that he wasn't enough of the Godel. He started with Magidus, saying Droshes, a new style of Droshes. The earlier Droshes, by the way, just like the Musa Svarim were learned only for the ideas in them, the earlier Droshes were agadic tiltul. They weren't given, they weren't organized expositions of Musa themes. They weren't attempts to inspire to certain tikkun of midas. There was Musa, yeah. I mean, the Magid would give them fire and brimstone over some kilkulim that there might have been in one area. Maybe they didn't daven with sufficient warmth, or with sufficient ispalos, or sufficient, I would say, slavos. So, or in another area, there would be something that was thought missing in the sphere of tzniyos or tzniyos mishpocha. The Musa was fire and brimstone, one second, but it was pilpul. So, it didn't instruct, elevate, edify. One side of but how were they used? Jews learned Yaras Vash. Right? 15 minutes Yaras Vash, and how before Purim there's a big inyan of Yaras Vash and all the Astoras and Megillas Esther. Good. So you even learned the Yaras Vash. But methods that they should elevate and inspire, and not just inspire emotionally alone, but through a total illumination of areas that needed inner development, that was not the method and style of the Magid. Either it was fire and brimstone, or else it was cold pilpul, but not in aloha, in agoda. So Jews would sit there, they loved Torah, you got to listen to the Magid. He would hammer away for 2 hours, so if it was fire and brimstone, they all cried. But if it was a pilpul and agoda, so after 2 or 3 minutes, you know, all 500 Jews lost it. Because they were not London, the people for whom the Magidim needed to speak. We're not talking about the Russian. We're talking about the states, like with the simple Jews. Al Koponin, he developed a new technique in the drushes. His drushes was given in Yiddish and based a lot, of course, on exposition of classic texts, were expositions, organized, illuminating, relevant to the soul issues of the day. There's a new kind of public discourse. Well, but the movement wasn't born yet. There was no movement. So we started thinking, what else could I do? Maybe I could organize groups of Balabatim whom I could convince to start pursuing this limud the way I hold they should learn it. So he established in Kovna, tried to establish Musa Shtiblech. Musa Shtiblech were places. There's one Beis HaMusar in Yerushalayim today, by the way. Somewhere near Ezra Story over there. That's where it is. Every once in a while there are sikhas over there, every week. What's a Beis HaMusar? Large number of Musa Shvarim available from all times and places. Absolute no outside intrusion, no distractions, seriousness, a place for aloneness, a place for his godliness, a place to learn Musa, to feel Musa, to think Musa, for groups of Jews to meet, either individually or together, to hear sikhas of the type that we will soon describe. And he hoped that this would be the foundation of the Jewish Muslim. He became after a while, sadly disappointed, became convinced that people who have already reached a certain establishment and they become habituated to their ways, that since the thrust of Musa was to turn the insides over, uproot the old midas and transform them, that with Balabatim, even if they were loved it, even if they were Yirei Hashem, they were already no longer in the formative stages but in the settled stages, aside the fact that all of the problems of life and the distractions of life and the troubles of living in an anti-Sib Russia and the troubles of Parnosis being under constant tension and being broken repeatedly, in addition to all that, the strength of habit militated against the chances of the new Musa Shita, that it should become a movement. So he came to the conclusion that the way to do it is for him to become a mashgiach in a yeshiva or in yeshivas. So he offered himself to become the Menahar Ruch Niyagaloshin. And he was not accepted. By then, the Chaim Riske was a young man, he was there already, he was the rising star of conceptualization. He did not agree that Musa would do the trick for Yechidim, would do it, would accomplish. He held that only learning, straight learning, would accomplish what needed to be accomplished. And he told Rabbi Yisrael, Musa is for sick people. We in Volozhna have it. We won't go into the Holy Land. We judge between the two. So Rabbi Yisrael was left from there. And in time, he acquired a number of individual Talmidim, Vilna, Anand Kovner, great individual Talmudim, didn't have any formal base, any formal platform. He was determined all of his life not to be dependent on anybody else for a livelihood, so he refused to become a Rav. He was once a Rosh Yeshiva for a brief period of time in Vilna, in Rav Milas Yeshiva, whose last Rosh Yeshiva was a Rav Gusman. It was a Rav Gusman, and then there was another goyim who was Rosh Hashiva Vera Mordechai Meltzer. So Salanta was invited to become a fellow, joint Rosh Hashiva. After a while, Rabbi Yisrael noted, started seeing that most of the Talmidim were being drawn away from Rav Meltzer's shiur and to join himself, and were drawn to Rabbi Yisrael. And one day he picked up and left the yeshiva. He said, "Oh, he didn't want to be guilty of that. You know, I break the heart of him personally, I've been a shiva the years before. I had been a successful Rosh Hashiva, so he, because he was a star, because he needs a market." Well, a Rav he wouldn't be, refused his whole life. Also would not take money from private people, except from several hand-picked Talmidim, from whom he took never more than the barest necessities of life. He was nifter, didn't leave a room. So, that's nothing. Yeah.
What was the time frame of this?
The time frame is now, by now, in other words, didn't leave a room. So, nothing. Become a fellow, joint Rosh Hashiva. After a while, Rabbi Yisrael noted, started seeing that most of the Talmidim were being drawn away from Rav Meltzer's shiur and to join himself, and were drawn to Rabbi Yisrael. And one day he picked up and left the yeshiva. He didn't want to be guilty of that. He didn't want to break the heart of the person who had been a Rosh Hashiva that he was before and had been a successful Rosh Hashiva. So he, because he was a star, because he needs a market. Well, a Rav he wouldn't be. He refused his whole life. Also would not take money from private people except from several hand-picked Talmidim, from whom he took never more than the barest necessities of life. He was nifter, didn't leave a room. So, nothing. Yeah?
What was the time frame of this?
The time frame is now, by now, in other words, this development of his looking through, it's the 1840s, 1850s, this is where he's looking to establish the movement. That's the time for.
Same the course of his life, though. You started when he was 32 or 33.
Yeah, and later, you'll soon hear what happened.
Until his first become Yidin?
That's right. In other words, he only had an effect in Russia, private Talmidim, who developed followings and who developed Musa yeshivas. Musa became became prevalent in the yeshivas, never became widespread in the kehillas. But in the yeshivas, it became widespread, and then it became prevalent after his p'tira. It was only in Kelem and in Slabodka later. Kelem was there during his time. There was a Beis HaMusar in Kelem, but it was not a major institution. As Alojin kept it out, it wasn't until after the closing of Alojin. Rabbi Sholem was already been there for a number of years. A few years later, Slabodka opened up. And a few years before that, Rabbi Tzala Petterburg had managed to establish a Musa Kailil in Kovna, which Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan in part headed up, but which Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan's son fought against. Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan's son, Rabbi Hirsch, was a Goyim Olam himself, and a great Tzaddik, and he and some other Goyim in Litta, we'll come to that, held that the Musa movement had to be stopped. They fought it hard. It wasn't until, what? Not openly. Yitzchak Elchanan stood with them, but didn't foster it. Yitzchak Elchanan was not, if it was a misnagid, he was a misnagid in here and in here. But around him, there were Goyim, especially after his p'tira, who came out blazing against the Musa movement. You come to that.
Alluded a couple times to a connection between the more conceptual approach of Reb Chaim, not being related to some of an anti-Lucifer, and Reb Yisrael being the Pashtun, and that
not because of
them
that. Towards
no,
no, connection. No. Aside from the method of learning, which Reb Chaim initiated and disseminated, Reb Chaim held that it was only the glow of halachic learning that could heal the soul of individuals around him. He held that any method extraneous to the inner learning of Shas conceptually might in the short run, you know, have great accomplishments, but in the long run, it would not solve the problems of the age.
Yeah. It should be mentioned that along with the emphasis on the study of the Musar text, Rousseau also felt very strongly that those sections of halacha that relate to interpersonal ethics need to be emphasized. So I'm just saying that idea of Rabbi Sol certainly could not be subject to any of the criticism on the part of the Volozhin community or anyone else.
It was deeply subject, because he held that that learning Musa for his followers hours a day, that would do it. It wasn't that the information conveyed in the texts that Rabbi Sol wanted to emphasize. That wasn't what bothered the anti-Musa people.
No, I understand, but I'm saying Rabbi Yisrael emphasized the need to study the halachic, to study the halachos of interpersonal ethics.
And economic, but they didn't single that out as a special limud with special emphasis. They held that you learn kol ha'tayra kula, and that's what heals. So, if you need a tikkun, avada, need a tikkun, so I must have to come and talk to this tzibur, or that tzibur, or this yochad, or that, be misakin yourself. But not that if he's going to spend hours a day working on betochen with exercises and with techniques and with methods to arouse one's emotions while he's learning these inyonim. See, those inyonim that Avada Rabbi Yisrael held, that the first principle is to learn the halachas of the inyon on which you have to learn Musa. But after that, you have to learn Musa by plunging yourself into an ocean. The ocean was opposed to it. Not because, again, it wasn't a doctrinal difference. It was a different outlook on Yadus. They both agreed that the Ben Adam L'Chavayra in Yonim needed Tikkun. How would they come to Tikkun? They were not going to come to Tikkun. Valojin held through the Musa movement. But I want to get back first. I haven't gone in, you noticed, into any attempts to define yet the inner Shidda. I haven't tried that yet. I want to get to that in the last moments that we'll have. The push of his life. his life. He's trying organizationally to get this shit, the shit off the ground. When did it get off the ground, really? It was the end of his life, the Kovna Kolel, which was fought, and the Beis HaMusar, the Beis HaTalmud, some people called it the Talmud Torah of Kelev. The Kelev of Talmud Torah, which Rav Simcha Zissel, Ziv, who was one of his three greatest Talmidim, established in Kelev, which incidentally was also an experiment, both in Musar, and an experiment in Torah Derech Eretz, at a lower level. It was the only place where, you know, a Goyan of that age attempted to establish a school where there would be Limudim Klolim in the yeshiva. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter never himself set foot in the institution. And he said that the only reason he gave Rishus to Rabbi Simcha Zissel to open it was that he was sure that if it would be necessary to close it, if Kilkulim would come out of it, Rabbi Simcha Zissel would close it. At a later time, I'm going to try to give you a little bit of a picture of what that, it was called a Talmud Torah, but it was really a place from here to there. What it looked like, what its whole inner mood was, what its style was, what anybody would see who would come in there. Hold your thoughts for a moment, just. So, it's there, it was in the Kovna Kolel, and then in Slabodka, which one of the two yeshivas in Slabodka. It was in Slabodka, in the yeshiva that was established as a Musa yeshiva, and in which the Lubavitch Mordechai was the Rosh Yeshiva, and the Mashgiach was Rav Moshe Hirsch, the Rautef of Slabodka, who was like a Talmud Chover. He was a Talmud Chover of Rav Simcha Zissel. He didn't agree with Rav Simcha Zissel in many things, but in many inyonim, he followed him, and he established the first large-scale Musa Yeshiva. As a result of the closing of Alojin, Slabodka became the model for the later yeshivas. And from there, we'll come to that, how it happened. Musa started spreading to the other major yeshivas. Came to Mir with more or less success at first, not until Rav Yeruchem came to Mir. Years and years later did Mir become a real Muslim yeshiva. It tells there were desperate battles. And in those battles, the Ponele Jerov, Zichrono Livracha, as a young boy, almost ended up a Masko and almost ended up a communist. And the Chofetz Chaim saved him. He was part of that war. He was used by the rebels against Moshe. It was the biggest, possibly the biggest ilui. I don't know if I have a right to say that. One of the big iluyim in Telz. So when the anti-Musar Talmidim broke away from Telz, they took him with them, and he became the Magid Shia for them. And after that, Kol HaMinim Ulchamas enveloped him and surrounded him. And he was saved somehow. Many were not. One of the Talmidim who turned sour then was a later Mapamnik by the name of Avraham Hartzfeld, who had been a Chavim or a Chavrusa of the college. And that guy turned into a radical, radical apotheos. 50 years later, that Avraham Hartzfeld made it possible for Parle Jerome to establish Parle Jerome. Didn't become a Chavayid, but he resolved he must have. So he opened the doors. You never can tell. He opened the doors of the Medina and the ministries, and that was at a time of Ben-Gurion's regime. It was a very heavy year, anti-that. And yet, you never could tell how things twirl, how they turn. I want to get back. At a certain stage, Rabbi Yisrael Salanter was offered the headship of a new Beis HaMedrash Rabbonim, a rabbinical theological seminary, which the Russian government and the Maskilim were interested in establishing in Vilna. The Maskilim had a notion that the Yisrael could be warm to their cause, because wasn't he emphasizing humanism? Wasn't he emphasizing Benodim Lachaveiro? Wasn't he emphasizing a certain kind of culture, which epistemically old from Yeshivish world then? Beis HaMedrash was not known, was not accepted, wasn't he at heart, maybe, one of them? Couldn't be anybody who was as powerful in his opposition to them as he was. And they said, "Now, find a seat."
So you're telling me this.
quality of old...
Yeah, so they saw he's rebelling and they're rebelling. So he's Mishalon of Yisrael. Okay. So they decide to press him, together with the Russian government, that he should become the head of this new rabbinical theological seminary that was going to produce a completely new type of rav for Russian Jewry. And little by little, they were going to remove the old leadership. It would take a generation or two. And Rabbi Yisrael would be the, you know, would be the gabbe over this. So Rabbi Yisrael said no, and then pressures of those character, we don't know exactly what sort of pressures were brought to bear on him. One nice day, he vanished, just fled Vilna. And he went to another province where there was another governor, Gubernia it was called. He went to Kovna, he was then for years had been living in Vilna, and he ran away. I will not go into now into what it was, you know, that why he was so opposed, why he ran away. We know he didn't want to be pressured into becoming a tool of the Haskalah against the whole Torah world then, and against the whole of Russian Jewry, which was largely a Torah community. Yeah. Not that he, no, he would be used as a tool. Even if he wouldn't give in personally.
But he wouldn't have any connection with
it. But he held that there was no way that that kind of school could produce real Kabbalah Chacham Eliyahu Rabbanu. Even if it were to remain from. Not that he would yield anything. He held that that style of chinuch could not produce real Tamilah Chachamim. And it couldn't produce real Rabbanim. So it would only be a cover-up, it would be a camouflage for something else. There was another such experiment in Zhytomyr, in which whose colors came through clearly. The person who headed up the Talmud department in Zhytomyr was a big lump. He was the author of the first sefer that attempted to make shalom between the Siddur and the Mishnah and the Haskalah. It was called Sholem Ad Yisroel. Get his name now. Get his name, Sholem Ad Yisroel. He with a big beard, and he was a lump, philosophic. He grieved over what happened there, but he ended up a tool. Yisroel was too big to become a tool. Ran away, because they brought pressures, and it was already dangerous for him to resist. He didn't just resist such an offer and such pressures. He gets himself to Kovna, runs away, and a short while later, decides, famous marshal, he decides that when a wagon is running downhill, so you can't stop the horses by running up from the bottom of the hill and going like this. The horses will crush you. And he came to the conclusion that Russian Jewry could only be saved by an effort from outside Russian Jewry. Imagine that. There were so many, millions upon millions of Jews from the Yidden. He already held that his work could not succeed unless it had support from an outside source. Where could he work? Strange to tell, what he really banked on was that he could produce, through a new tshuva movement, a new kind of purity and spirituality, which would become a challenge and an inspiration to that then enormous big world of Frum from birth, and Lev Gatera from birth, and Yireh Shemayim from birth, but who were already hardened in their ways. So it needed something from where? From Germany, from France. Most of his life afterwards was already spent in Germany and France. He began to live in Königsberg for 10 years. Started working with students. Had an enormous impact on them. Yeah, Königsberg was already in Germany. He was careful not to say to Lithuanian Jews from his... I described to you the geographic area where he lived, that there was a lot of give and take, travel, commerce. Whenever he saw a Lithuanian Jew in the Beis HaMedrash in Königsberg, he would fold up, wouldn't say, wouldn't talk. Because these needed to hear something different than those needed to hear. And there were all sorts of stories how he would plead with somebody to smoke one cigarette less next Shabbos, or this Shabbos, that kind of stuff. He taught businessmen who had to unload. It was a port city, Kennysburg, so they had to unload their loads. So he said, well, yeah, okay. To unload on Shabbos, you can't escape. But let's see how many derises you can avoid. So he chipped them down. There were hundreds of Jews who became Shemra Mitzvah. But his ikir impact was on students. he met one long night with Rav Shamsha Rafael Hirsch and with Rav Meir Lema. I don't know if it was in Berlin. I think it was in Berlin. And he went through the 19 letters in translation from the German. And he then came to the conclusion that the Sefer needed translation into Hebrew. And he spearheaded it, even though it didn't come to pass in his time, but the late 1880s, two Yidden, one Rav Samuzal and Aronson, and one who was one of the Rosh Hashivas in Telz then, did the first two works in Lashon HaKodesh based on Hirsch. One was Meitav Higoyim, I think it was Hirsch's own. And one, Meitav Higoyim is a sort of a condensation and a redoing of some of the basic ideas of Hirsch and Chumash. But the Geras Sofon, that was translated by a certain Talmud Chacham in Vilna, with Haskamas from the Yitzchok Chonon, later from Reb Chaim Moshe. Haskamas were given then to the Pirush of Hirsch and Torah, which is most likely called Nachlas Tzvi, which Reb Yitzchok Chonon gave a glowing Haskama to it, even though he couldn't learn it. Couldn't read it because didn't know German. I was trying to go translating in a whole five volumes like that, six volumes at that time, Al Kaponim, but he was so moved by its contents that he then wrote that it was necessary for all of the works of Hirsch to be translated into Lashon HaKodesh. He also undertook then to get Shas translated into a number of European languages, and he attempted to establish cathedras in Judaic studies in German universities. He held that if this effort would succeed, and the learning of Talmud would become, and the part of Jewish semi or totally assimilated students would become respectable. So this whole stream of yeshiva bachrim and shtibul bachrim running from the shtiblech and from the yeshivas, they would meet a world which would say to them, well, what are you guys running for? You know, it's doing over here. You just didn't learn it right. We have something of a similar happening in our times, which I don't want to expand on too much, but you're aware, I'm sure, what I mean. You know, when you get somebody who's been there already, and he starts saying, or a few hundred or a few thousand, and they start saying, wow, there's nothing that compares in that world to this Rashbo. So then, some yeshiva bacher, you know, who has become already, you know, Mr. Samashim Olamada style, and he's tearing at the reins because he wants out, and he comes upon some of these chevra, and he sees a world of this kind, it has an effect. He was hoping for more than this. He was hoping for a top-flight respectability to come in academic circles. The big Yetzirah then wasn't the Yetzirah of our day. It wasn't a cheap, vulgar Yetzirah. There was an intellectual Yetzirah. And if this kind of limud could become accepted and respected in those halls of a kind of Western secular learning, which in the heart of hearts, you know, every second yeshiva bocher had that Yetzirah tugging at him. If only he could get to Heidelberg or Berlin. Well, if he would find, you know, something like this happening there, it didn't work. We found out after a while that the people doing the translation, when they got to the Agodis, that they tampered with the Agodis, that they that the notes that were written, the commentaries that began to be written, were Haskalic in nature. And we're headed towards a completely non-Torah approach to Shas. He stopped. I remember now another thing, I couldn't remember the name for a while. He had a top Talmud, an Ilui Yotzer, by the name of Einhorn, whom he sent himself to the University of St. Petersburg in the hope that he would become the first model of a Talmud Chacham, who would be, you know, master of Shas, and the Yerei Shemayim, and would succeed at the highest levels of the Russian academic world. That would be an example. That individual, that Einhorn, was a cohort of the effort, and he became the later, I think, general surgeon of the Russian army, General Einhorn. He became a machine. He could have then, he sort of pulled back. I gave you a lot, you know, in a few sentences. These are years of efforts. Pulled back brokenhearted, and he walked away from the attempt, you know, at cure by reaching out. Started reaching in. then he turned his attention. What?
Did he speak German?
A little. But he dressed German style when he was there. He understood German well. He could make himself understood. His manner was impeccably Western when he was... It's interesting to note, unlike his own behavior, I thought it would be sort of a Fulanian sort, nobody could catch him not dressed according to the latest conservative fashion, no Rabbanische clothing. When he was there, you know, he looked like a German aristocrat, Lahavdil. Goes to Paris, and he sees something else is happening that begins to bother him greatly. I'm going to stop here in a minute right now. He saw the beginnings of the Hagira, the great immigration, right after the 1881. He saw that Jews are going out of this world, out of this country, out of this old Russian Empire. And who knows where they're headed for? Now, how far are they going? Some are going to America, maybe it can be staved off. Some are going to England. Well, in England, the Masnadlo was there. It didn't succeed too much, but the Masnadlo was a brother of Yeshua, the founder of the United Synagogue, founder of the London Besen, founder of what later became Jewish College, but was originally a focused Torah institution. So he's not headed for London. But in Paris, he discovers that there are some hundreds or already thousands of migrants who are from the Yemen and have no leadership. What will happen to them could be a forerunner of what's going to happen to unknown masses, unknown numbers of masses of Russian and Polish and Lithuanian and Galician Jews are going to be headed away from the earlier motherland, and who knows, maybe they'll get across the ocean. Has to establish something. In his old age, he takes himself to Paris, doesn't know French, doesn't know the language, and organizes the first Torah Tru Kehillah of East European Jews in France, and brought over a leading rov, I believe was, if I'm not mistaken, was a Polish Chassidish rov, but brought him over to be the rov of that Kehillah, and while there, he had a terrible accident. He fell down a flight of stairs once. He was not well. He was alone. He ended up going back. I believe that he was Niftar in Petersburg, never made it back to Russia. During all of these years, he would visit Russia occasionally, kept up a very close correspondence with all of his leading public. How he was Niftar, this I must tell you, even though I can't get into the ship and it's from really after poor, but we'll be back doing some tonight. It's very important to be done right, but I don't want to do it just a finger and walk away from it. On the day of his Ptira, there was one lone Shamus who was with him. And he saw, felt his coat was gone, and his family wasn't there. One of his children, by the way, in his lifetime, turned away from Yiddishkeit. Another was a big one. Children of that one who turned away from Yiddishkeit ended up in America establishing, already as assimilated Jews, the ethical culture movement. The head of the ethical culture movement was an Adler, its founder in America. And so Salante, his name for certain reasons was Lipkin, and for certain reasons changed to Adler.
Felix Adler
was a great grandson. Was a grandson or a great grandson? Mrs. De Sola Poole had a sister. She was the wife of the rabbi of the Spanish church. She had a sister who was a top leader of that movement in America. And look how full of this. There was also a lot to move heaven and earth that the son who ended up in a university and ended up going away from Shemir HaMitzvahs, he moved heaven and earth that without his knowledge that son should be at least fed kosher food. Didn't give up on anybody. The day of his death, the last hours, he felt the end is coming. What does he worry about in such a thing? That this poor Shamus shouldn't be frightened and upset too much by death. The last Musasicha consisted of Chizuk and the Chama given to this Shamus with his last purpose, that there really isn't too much to be afraid of when you're in the presence of the dying person. Not to be afraid even if the person dies. Until he calmed him down, to him. That was his last concern, that another yid shouldn't suffer any mental anguish over his last karaches, you know, he's departing from life. Enough shetzvot zahar hai. Yet Hashem, next week of the Purim, and then 2 weeks from tonight, we'll take a look at the Yisrael Shiva.